This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And in the studio with us is Charles Sauer, libertarian economist, president of the Market Institute, marketinstitute.org. You can tweet him at Charles Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. And Charles, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
It's always nice having you here in the studio with us. So let's talk about some issues here. I have two, and I'll just share these stories as setup. Okay. The first is from the New York Times today. Steve Erlinger, the headline, "After Grenville Tower Fire, United Kingdom asks, has deregulation gone too far?" Turns out that they have now found 120 high-rises that are clad. The outside is covered with this aluminum siding that has polyethylene in the middle of it, which is highly flammable, which is why all these people died in this tower. Which, by the way, you can't sell for towers in the United States. It's only good, it's only authorized for buildings 12 feet tall or shorter. But in the UK, I'll read you from the story. This started with Maggie Thatcher. Mrs. Thatcher introduced the right to buy social housing to its tenants in 1980. Over time, the nature of social housing changed. Some apartments became simply private rental properties, including an unknown number in Grenfell Tower itself. Under conservative efforts since 2010 to reduce the national budget and the national debt, state funding was reduced or frozen for many parts of the government, including local councils, which we would call, you know, city councils or whatever. Deregulation also meant outsourcing responsibility for fire inspections to the owners of the buildings instead of the civil servants. So the owners of the buildings are saying, oh, yeah, well, so it's flammable. It's cheaper, you know, it's cheaper. And, you know, and a bunch of people are dead. Meanwhile, here in the United States, Scott Pruitt and his Environmental Protection Agency are, this from Oliver Millman in today's Guardian, the EPA is poised to dismantle the federal Clean Water Rule, which protects waterways that provide drinking water to about a third of the U.S. population. Scott Pruitt said, "We are taking significant action to return power to the states and provide regulatory certainty to our nation's farmers and businesses."
That's a great man.
Yeah, well, they had regulatory certainty before. They knew what the law was. But in any case, green groups have said that the move pandered to fossil fuel and farming interests was part of an agenda to weaken clean water protections led by farmers and golf course operators. And the National Mining Association welcomed its impending demise. So in recent months, the EPA has wound back rules curbing vehicle emissions, toxic waste from power plants, and methane leaks from oil and gas drilling operations. So basically, here in the United States, they're making our environment more poisonous in order to increase the profits of industry. And in the UK, they're making their buildings more deadly in order to increase the profit of landlords. And all of this in the name of deregulation. What's a libertarian to say?
Well, let's start with the London thing first. First off, that the building fire was a tragedy. There's no political side to the fact of whether that was a tragedy or not. Politically or government-wise, there is a major issue. There's a problem when you have this public-private relationship going on. There is this, the incentives are incorrect. The incentives when the government is giving funding to a private person to supply these services, then their incentive is to provide the cheapest services as possible.
How is that any different from if they're buying them in the so-called free market?
Because if you're in the free market and your building just went up in fire, you know, you're not going to make money from that tomorrow.
I don't think that, you know, there's a lot of people in the government housing who are moving out right now, too.
Well, now who does the public hold accountable? Do they vote out these politicians that weren't the ones to put those policies in place? The market can't correct the way when a government's involved, the way that it is when the private sector is the one controlling. So in London, what you have, again, both sides were wrong here, but the incentives were set up because of this weird public-private mix. We see it in healthcare in the United States.
Because of greed. The fact that the money for building these buildings came from the UK government and some of the ongoing maintenance costs, I don't see how that's any different than it came from, you know, private investors. I mean, they're still going to say, do it as cheaply as you can. We want a big dividend on our investment.
No, I mean, that's a business is looking at returns tomorrow and returns in the future. The government
not businesses in this day and age. They're looking at the next quarter.
That's that is a CEO who is going to be out of a job in a few quarters, right?
Right, with his $30 million parachute. That's all he wants.
No, well, that's not the incentive for the board of directors. That's not the incentive for the companies in the long run. If we switch over to water, we can actually look at where private water is delivered in the U.S. They have a better track record than public water systems, and it's just because of this incentive for a private system to look out towards investing in infrastructure. Detroit's a good example of this.
Better track record at what?
At they have less infractions per million people served from the EPA.
Private water system. Yeah, but you know, we have no idea why that is. I mean, many of the water systems that have been privatized were water systems that were like in really, really great shape. And the companies wanted to come in and buy them up. We got French water companies. Afina, I think, is the name of the big one.
Yep.
You've got Australian water companies. I mean, a lot of the water operations in the United States are not owned by Americans even. They're owned by foreign companies. And they're not interested in buying a water system in crisis like Flint, Michigan. They're only going to buy the water systems that are just like running smooth as silk. And so if you then look at those systems, you'd say, oh, those systems are fine. Well, they're fine because public money made them fine to begin with.
And I will
building.
I disagree with a part of that, but because after it's privatized, the incentive for the private company is to maintain that system because now they have a source to profit. Not only is their incentive the long term profits, their incentive is to also not supply the wealthy people that live outside of the city, but it's to supply the people where most of their money's coming from, which is where you can have a dense mass of population.
This is the biggest problem with privatized water systems, this is why you had the REA, the Rural Electrification Administration, the RTA, the Rural Telephony Administration under Roosevelt and Eisenhower, respectively, because for-profit telephone companies, for-profit electric companies had no interest in running unprofitable lines out into the country. And the same with water, but
that's a lot of what left those farmers and ranchers out there in those lands, even though the lands were never going to be profitable. I mentioned this last week when we switched roles, but what I didn't mention was that the subsidies that went to help the people in the hill country helped keep them in poverty for the years to come because their property was never meant to be developed. It doesn't get enough rain per year.
By whom?
Nature. I mean,
well, couldn't you say that about the city of Phoenix or Vegas?
If people move there and they were getting
nature never intended for a city to be in Phoenix. It's desert or Las Vegas. I mean, but people did it.
I don't know the history of the rural electric going in Vegas, but the rural electric going into rural Texas. Kept people where they didn't get enough rainfall per year to grow crops. And yet where the federal government was spending money to keep these poor people in poverty.
They're going to stay in their homes just because now they have electricity?
They were, and they did. And that helped keep them out there even longer than they should have. Helped soil erosion, helped a lot of things.
That seems like a pretty weak argument. And none of this addresses the issue that I originally set here, which is regulation, government regulation in the United States says you may not build a skyscraper that is covered with flammable material. Maggie Thatcher said regulation is a terrible thing. They deregulated it in the UK and people died. Here in the United States with regard to water, the EPA was protecting one third of all our waters through the Clean Water Rule. And now they're going to dial that back so the coal miners and coke industries and other big polluters can dump more crap in the water.
That's completely incorrect, right? So President Obama implemented in 2015 WOTUS, the Waters of the United States Act, which, you know, a lot of the right pans as regulating puddles. Although, actually, I would say in the rule it says that it does not involve puddles. But they don't define puddles. So a lot of the right is still about that. But the courts put a stay. The sixth district court stayed that rule back in 2015. So it was put in 2015, stayed in 2015. All that Trump is doing is saying, hey, let's clarify this and say we'll roll back to the 2015 language. They're putting that back in until we can figure out in the courts what it meant.
My understanding of this is that the Waters of the U.S. rule wasn't some brand new regulation. There were some pieces to it, but it consolidated a lot of existing regulations. And that what these big polluters want is to blow away those regulations that in many cases have been here since the 70s. And that were essentially reincorporated under the Waters of the U.S. rule. In fact, if you read the legislation, about three quarters of it is referenced to other laws. It's that arcane legal language. So it wasn't some new thing that they came up with.
Let me make the arcane legal language pretty simple.
Well, no, very simply, why should we not have government regulations protecting our water and from being poisoned and our buildings from being flammable?
Well, again, everything that was in law pre-2015 will still be in law.
No, you're not answering my question. Why should we not have government regulations?
The question doesn't make any sense because you said the hardest that all that WOTUS did, all that this Waters of the United States rule did was codify a bunch of things from 2015.
In that case,
the Scott Pruitt administration's not doing anything. All that they're rolling back is the legal uncertainty of what was put in the 2015 rule.
I'm trying to take us out of the weeds here and take us to 30,000 feet. Why are you opposed to government regulation that protects our water and protects our buildings? I don't get it. Why would you be opposed to that?
That's a question that wasn't involved in the setup here because the private market enforces its own version of regulations, and that's by having the profit motive.
In 2008.
That's by having the profit motive out ahead. Again, that's a place where the government mandated who they had to give loans to, the numbers they had to give the roles to. It's where this interaction.
There was no mandate. You're going to try and pull out that Jimmy Carter, it's all his fault thing, because he ended redlining?
Yep. That's
He didn't say you have to loan to people in black neighborhoods. He said you can no longer refuse to loan to people simply because they live in a black neighborhood. But if they got lousy credit, you can turn them down.
I can't think of it off the top of my head right now, but I believe that there was some Clinton era stuff on that as well. I believe that George W. Bush is not out of this one. There's incentives to increase the loans in subprime loans, and the banks took advantage of those and ran it into a place that shouldn't be there. Okay. It's the intersection.
Charles, you have the last word. Charles Sauer, at Charles Sauer, marketinstitute.org. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's always fascinating talking to Charles. It's, get our different worldviews out there. Monty in Phillipsburg, Missouri. Hey, Monty, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's on your mind today?
Well, I'm actually watching on Roku.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine, too. So what's up?
Yeah. I really like your show and stuff. I've been a long time listener and watcher.
Thank you.
What I want to talk about, actually, I wanted to try to get in when the congressman was, but I didn't get in. My two things is I've asked my congresswoman, Vicki Hartzler, when the veterans were going to get and government workers were going to get raises for the 2 years that we didn't receive raises.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not for sure on do you know what the rate of inflation was those first 2 years?
What were the years?
I think 08 and 09, right after the crash.
The inflation was negative at that point.
Yeah, negative. I know, but afterwards that it happened?
The rate of inflation has not exceeded 2% since 2008. It's been stuck in the, over the last 5 years anyway, it's been stuck in the between 1% and 2% range.
Okay. Well, for me, looking at it, I've looked at it far as...
People on Social Security got screwed too, Monty. They also did not get a raise because
exactly. You're on a fixed income, and I went from having savings. I have no more bills than what I had then. Just everything else has went up. I went from having savings and having spending, extra spending money, paid all my bills, whereas now, plus money that I could actually go spend out and have a good time, which is approximately 1/3 of my income is gone.
Yeah.
In this last 10
years. A lot of this money has to do with the way that they calculate the cost of living adjustments. And the way that they calculate the cost of living adjustments for Social Security, for example, make no sense because a lot of it has to do with technology. If the cost of computers goes down and the power of computers goes up, then they figure everybody's living cheaper, right? But elderly people don't buy new computers every year or new phones. And I would say probably a lot of soldiers don't either. You know, they're living a lot closer to the bone. And so the rate of medical inflation, the rate of housing inflation, the rate of educational inflation, those are all running, you know, way above 2% a year. I mean, they're substantial, but they're not considered in the equation the way that they should be. I think that we need to have a fundamental recalibration of how we do these cost of living adjustments.
Exactly. And like I said, I figured, one third of my income had gone away, and I figured it out, which I actually went with a 10% across the board that we missed out on just across the board the last 10 years. And just in the 10%, you had, let's just say 10% each year that you lost. I figured out that's $300 a month on a $3,000 totally disabled veteran on out. That would be like 32 or $36,000.
$300 a month would be $3,600 a year.
Yeah, $3,600 times 10.
Right, $36,000 a decade. Yeah,
exactly.
Good point.
Imani, you got screwed,
and I agree with you. And so did a lot of our GIs, and so did a lot of people living on fixed incomes, particularly on Social Security. And Bernie was all over this actually. You know, during the primary, he was talking about it a lot. Imani, I got to run, but thank you for the call. I wish you the very best. Thank you for the call. We'll be right back.
On April 15th, 1949, Pacifica Radio KPFA 94.1 FM, Berkeley, California, went on the air for the first time, introducing listener-sponsored community radio to America.
Racism is not simply about the color. It's about structures of oppression and repression. And today, it is impossible really to understand the nature of racism unless we also recognize the role that the so-called war against terror has played.
American political activist, scholar, and author Angela Davis. Did you know that you can get most any of the 50,000 Pacifica broadcasts in our collection? Visit us online at PacificaRadioArchives.org and help support the Archives' mission to preserve Pacifica's broadcast legacy.
Welcome to the Million Color Revolution.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Billy in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hey, Billy, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Hey, Scott Pruitt's from Oklahoma, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I lived over there for 15 years. I was a landscaper. There were numerous friends of mine that got bladder cancer and tumors on their bladders because of the water in Oklahoma, because strychnine is so heavy in that water and the regulations are so bad that you're drinking that every day. And if you drink a bunch of it, a couple of my friends were mailmen, and you know how much water they drink.
Right.
And I tell you what, they would start bleeding, and I had problems over there too. But you start bleeding from your kidneys, and it's from so much strychnine, it's in their water over there.
Whoa.
Scott Pruitt, he was, you know, I cannot even believe he's where he's at.
Yeah.
In Trump's organization.
Well, he's there because he's been a loyal soldier for the Koch network.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's really that simple. The Kochs have basically, taken over this country. The Koch network has basically taken over this country. And so you get people, you know, this lowest common denominator like Scott Pruitt. And, that's where we go. So say 1 minute to go. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Billy, I got to run, but thank you for the call. Bill in Camp Wood, Texas. Hey, Bill, we got a minute to the break. What's up?
Okay, I wanted to talk about the opioid so-called epidemic.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but what I see on TV is that mostly it's white people that are being affected.
Yes.
And all you hear on
in rural communities,
politicians wanting to do the prevention part or the healthcare part of it, and I think it's because that it's now affecting white people.
Yeah, when black people were dropping like flies back in the 80s, because.
Right.
Because all these drugs were being imported in the United States in the Iran-Contra deal, you know, it was like, oh, yeah, they deserve what they get, right? Or
right.
Throw them in prison. But now that white people are dropping dead from opiates, it's like, oh, my God, we got to do something. And
right.
Not that we shouldn't be doing something. We should have been doing something all along is my point.
Right. But it just looked to me like that all of a sudden it's white people now, so now we got to do something.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know... It's the way it is in the United States. It shouldn't be. And we need to be waking up from this stuff. But, yeah. Bill, thanks for the call. And I want to get into that opioid epidemic a little bit, maybe after the break or maybe tomorrow. I don't know. We'll see how this shakes out. I've still got a half a dozen stories here to share with you. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this.
All the important stories we cover and the issues we care about are at HartmanReport.com. Members of our community can comment and join the conversation.
So red alert, pay attention. Mitch McConnell says he's going to roll this thing back out on Friday when nobody's paying attention. Everybody's trying to get out of town for the 4th of July weekend. You know, that night people are, oh, you know, big weekend coming up. Let's go party. And what are the Republicans going to be doing? They're going to be pushing this stuff through the Senate. Or at least that seems to be the plan from everything I'm seeing on Fox so-called news. You know, obviously not the best news source, but who knows? Anyhow, Jill in Milwaukee. Hey, Jill, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. So, yeah, as everybody knows, I'm from Wisconsin, and our illustrious Senator Ron Johnson is one of the Republicans holding out, hedging on his vote for this Trump don't care wealth care bill.
Mm-hmm.
So we would like to help him along, and we are having a eulogy die-in tonight outside of his downtown Milwaukee office. It
oh,
is
great.
In the heart of downtown Milwaukee, 517 East Wisconsin Avenue at 6 o'clock tonight. It is during rush hour and high visibility area. So please, we need everybody down there that cares about this thing to try to sway his vote possibly.
Great. Well, good luck, Jill, and give us a call tomorrow and let us know how it worked out, okay?
I sure will, Tom. Thanks.
Great. Okay. Thanks a lot, Jill. Andrea in San Jose, California. Hey, Andrea, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to comment on the lady who called in and said that landlords were unfair for charging application fees for everyone applying for, you know, to rent an apartment
sure.
or a home.
Yeah, I'd never heard of this before.
Oh, yeah. Well, in California, we are able to charge an application fee, which allow us to do background checks and credit checks mm-hmm. on everyone who's going to move in over the age of 18.
But why not take the money for the cost of that out of the profit that you make renting the apartment units? Why charge people who may be, you know, applying to 10 or 12 different, you know, places? I mean, basically the burden for this is on the people who are least able to pay it, whereas somebody who actually owns an apartment building, I would assume, has the means to cover the cost of a background check.
Well, if I'm interviewing 10 people to rent my home, then that's a cost that, you know, I'm not willing to pay.
Right, but you know, I've been a landlord. I've owned houses where the year that we lived in Germany, we rented out our house in Marietta, and so I have some small amount of experience with this. And I ran a background check on the people that we ended up renting to. I never charged them for it. I charged them rent every month, and that rent was a profit to me.
Yeah, well, actually, so this time I'm in the process of renting now. I'm going to do things a little differently, and I'm going to look at applications first, and then potential tenants, I'll charge them an application fee, but We also run a risk of discriminating, because if you don't charge everyone a fee, then, you know, how it is sort of discriminating.
Well, why not choose no one, charge no one a fee? And when you get down to the say, three people that you think are really seriously, you know, these are the people that I really like to rent to from based on everything I see, then you pick up the cost for the credit check and background check. And you just build that into the cost of your rent. I mean, if you have to raise the cost of your rent by $10 a month so that over the course of the first year you recover that $120, which is more than your cost, nobody would even notice it. But you know, why should any landlord, you know, be putting tenants? I mean, people who have to rent rather than buy are among the most vulnerable in our country. Why are they being saddled with this extra cost? I don't get it.
Well, you know, along with that, you have to get their permission to run a credit check.
Sure.
Or a background.
And they'll give it to you. They'll give it to you. When I was on the board of the homeowners association for the community we lived on in Portland, Oregon, this floating home community, every person who to buy a house, and this wasn't to rent because we had no rental properties there, but to buy a house, the homeowners association ran a background check, a credit check, and a police check on people. We just picked up the cost.
Okay.
Why not do that?
Well, like I said, you know, it is a cost that I'm not willing to incur.
Right, but you could get it by simply raising your rent by $5 or $10 a month.
Well,
seems to me. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, and you know, I'm sorry if I don't sound empathetic, Andrea, but I just, you know, anytime I see policies that end up charging people at the bottom of the economic heap more money, and people higher up the economic heap are pushing those costs down on people below them, my is this fair, you know, meter goes off or whatever. Anyhow, we're starting to talk in circles. Andrea, I'm going to let you go, but thank you for the call. I get it that not everybody's some kind of evil landlord that's just trying to screw people. And I hope you don't think that I'm suggesting that of you. I'm just suggesting that perhaps tweaking your business model would be more fair. Thank you for the call, though. Nicole in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Hey, Nicole, what's up?
Oh, hi. I mean, talking a little bit about what he was saying, I think there is an online service that you just pay one flat fee and you can just check anybody's fee, like over the course of a year. But that's not
the reason. Yeah, it's getting easier and easier. Yes.
Yeah. So at any rate, you know, getting back to the situation about this medical, you know, like we need one single payer. I came across two ladies that live in Wisconsin. I was buying their backyard decorations because they're either going to have to walk away from the house or just sell the house because they were paying for their two husbands' medical bills of cancer. One lady was telling me she had been paying $10,000 a week. Her taxes are $15,000. She's taking care of her disabled brother. And these are affluent white women living in very beautiful homes. And I'm this lady buying their decorations. And I am in the brink of losing my home in Milwaukee because they charged me $28,000 in fines over a lateral that used to be the city of Milwaukee's lateral. So, you know, you put infrastructure in that was part of the city's responsibility on the homeowner. And then you add all these medical costs on regular affluent white people.
Yeah.
And I think this is why some people are wondering, well, why is it that white people are not sympathetic of the black person's plight is because I think they're eroding the white affluent white people.
Well, let's be very clear here, Nicole. They're eroding the affluence of everybody who earns less than $300,000 a year in the United States. Everybody else's income has been going down. Expenses are going up. You know, I'd rather not racialize this, although there are, you know, there is an argument to be made there. But yeah, wow, what a story.
What I was trying to say, Tom, I know let's not racialize it, but I think we have a disconnect. I'm a Latina. I'm going in this highly affluent suburb that I don't live anywhere near, but I made a connection with these poor ladies. I was praying with them, and they're crying in my shoulders. And I think this is where we have a disconnect in our society. And I just wanted to make that comment. And thank you, Tom, for all that you provide and information in the speakers that you have.
Well, thank you, Nicole. Thanks for sharing. That's a fascinating story. Thank you for sharing that with us and your perspective. I appreciate it. Karen in Winter Haven, Florida. Hey, Karen, what's up?
This afternoon I just caught a article that's been published in the Washington Post here today by a Max Ehrenfrund with a title called $15 minimum wage cost jobs.
Yeah, there's two studies. One came out of the University of Washington, and one came out of another group. The one that came out of the University of Washington said that the increase in the minimum wage in Washington State was actually costing jobs. I would encourage you to check out Dean Baker's website. I think it's cepr.org, Center for Economic and Policy Research. The study that the university released was methodologically flawed. They had a bunch of assumptions in it, and they also were using data that was irrelevant. I mean, basically, they had a conclusion, and they tried to build a study to achieve that conclusion. Another study that was issued the day before said that the minimum wage increase in Seattle did not cost jobs. And so, it's like what you have here is arguably is dueling studies. I think that the study that says that it's going to lose jobs, the right wing is running with this like crazy, but it is a badly flawed study. I've read the critique of it, and I think it's a good critique. The study sucks. Karen, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Let's see here. Actually, let's hit a break here because we're coming up on 15 minutes before the hour, and I guess it's 17 minutes before the hour, but close enough. And we'll be back with more of your calls after this, but stick around. It's the Tom Hartman Program, and more of the news of the day, your calls, and my thoughts on same.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Apologies. Dean Baker's website is cepr.net, not .org, .net, cepr.net. And welcome back. EPA, well, actually, the Grenville Tower thing, I wanted to just give you a little more detail on both of these. The Grenville Tower story, this Steve Erlinger writing in today's New York Times, cladding on each of the 120 high-rises tested so far. Cladding is, basically siding. We call it siding here in the United States. And it's aluminum siding at that. And inside, between the inner layer of aluminum and the outer layer of aluminum, there's a sheet of polyethylene, which acts as an insulator, a temperature insulator. But it is a highly flammable plastic. And aluminum actually is highly flammable. It burns like crazy. It doesn't ignite until it's like 1,300 degrees, something like that. But once it ignites, it burns. And so this is why this Grenfell Tower, went up so badly. And now in the UK, they've got 120 of these buildings that have been covered with this stuff in every case because it was cheap. It was cheaper than the fireproof stuff. And people die. I mean, I just don't think the argument that, the market will take care of you. No, there's a lot of things the market doesn't take care of. What the market's really good at is making rich people richer. That's the main thing that the market is good at. Stephanie in Winterville, California, Georgia, excuse me. Hey, Stephanie, what's up?
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Wanted to piggyback a little bit off of what I think the caller that you just had, Nicole, was mentioning about poor, like working class women, and I guess I wanted to try to tie this into. I work with a lot of guys, and I work at I work in retail. I make just above minimum wage. And I hear, and the men that I work with don't make much more than I do. And I hear them kind of, I'm in a red state, and I hear this resentment about, oh, well, Obamacare, it made me have to pay as a male, I'm having to pay the same price as women, for women who need a reproductive health care plan, and that doesn't benefit me at all. Right. And it just, I've been thinking about,
Here's the ultimate rebuttal, Stephanie.
Uh-huh.
The last time there was an Immaculate Conception, even alleged, was 2,000 years ago. What part of men being involved in reproduction do you guys not understand?
D-
Definitely. I mean, and I've used that argument with people in conversation. I was just trying to, going beyond that, I started thinking about how Republicans are really, they're so good at, like, scapegoating low-income women, and especially here, you know, I do think it's related to the history of racism that we have in this country, because you can kind of subtly get, like, working-class white men to really think of it, to really envision it as, like, oh, these black women that want to kind of reproduce, like, live off the state and be like, what is it, the welfare mom thing, right. Which is a complete myth. Like, I am a low-income woman, and I'm white, and it's not, like you said, it's also men are implicit in when women become pregnant. It's not something that women do on their own. But I just think that the Republicans have really, you know, it's easier when you're a working-class person, even if you're male and you're struggling, to kind of find a scapegoat who has even less social power than you,
yep,
like black women or women in general.
Yeah, I agree. It was the old Kris Kristofferson song, Everybody's Got to Have Somebody to Look Down On. That, you know, tragically, that's exactly the game the Republicans are playing. Stephanie, thank you so much. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you, and Joy in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Joy, thanks for listening on SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks. I love the contributions by all of your listeners and callers. I am living in, I raised four children in a middle-class neighborhood, and we lost a lot. I have children with special needs. My kids grew up being told no a lot. We couldn't do it. We couldn't afford it. And they lived amongst kids, their peers and schoolmates that were afforded every entitlement that they believed they were due. My kids still today, the good thing that comes out of that is that it really builds ethical and moral fiber of an individual. And the history of this country was built on imperialism, and I have more than you have, and we own this land. And it's so ingrained into our mentality that selfishness abounds everywhere. When my husband lost his job, and we were really struggling, I had to apply for assistance. I had food stamp ATM card. I had Medicaid for my son who has autism. We went through some really, really hard times after a loss of a business from which we never recovered. I have moved now. I'm ready to move in 2 days, actually, into the sixth home in 10 years. So it has caused me a lot of struggle. My point is that I showed up in that DCF office an educated person, and I had my copies because I had a copier printer at home. And I was able to navigate the system as an educated person. But if I wanted to, if you need the help, you can't hold a job, because you have to be in that office all day, yeah, waiting your turn.
And it doesn't even always work out, Joy. Last year in Mississippi, only 3% of people who applied for welfare benefits got them.
Right. And once you, when we finally got, I mean, thanks to Obama, I could have died and had to get a very, I had a dangerous thing and I had to have a procedure done. And I was getting aid that allowed me to have the medical procedure. And I also went back to school and got a degree. And now I'm working in special education. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing what I can. But I know that I'll never get out from underneath the struggle that we experienced for 6 years. It's impossible. But the minute we found jobs after more than a year and were earning an income, they withdrew everything. So we couldn't get back on our feet.
You mean they garnished your bank accounts? Is that what you mean?
No, they just stopped aid.
Oh, I see.
You know, if you're honest and you're getting paid with, you know, and getting income tax taken out,
you're it's public record
right.
The IRS about those that are linked. The moment you're making money, they stop your aid.
Right.
So
when you really need a transition period.
You need a transition period. There are people on welfare who will make less with minimum wage and will not, that literally will not be able to feed their families if they get a job.
Right.
So the system itself is broken.
Yeah. This is Yeah, I agree, Joy. And this is where I think if we had a universal basic income in the United States, it could replace about 90% of our social welfare programs, and would massively reduce the paperwork workload, the bureaucratic hassle, everything else. And that's why, you know, you've got, you know, four cities and four or five countries who are trying this out. But your point is really, really, really well taken, Joy. And thanks for sharing your story with us. I've got to move along, but thank you. Thank you very much. David in Palm Coast, Florida. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing? I love your show.
Thank you.
Hey, first off, I'm not a Democrat, not a Republican. I just kind of observe both
That's
parties,
fine.
But what I do. But I wanted your opinion on just a couple of things. This health care plan the Republicans are trying to push through, I was wondering, what's your opinion, or what's the difference in how they're doing it and how the Obama administration did it with Nancy Pelosi, where you had to sign it before you read it.
Right. That was a joke when Nancy Pelosi said that. David, when Nancy Pelosi said that, it was a joke. The fact of the matter is that Obamacare had over 50 public hearings. The Republicans offered dozens of amendments. Many of them were accepted. For example, the Mark Pocan was talking earlier about one of the amendments that the Republicans offered in committee. Was that all members of Congress must go on Obamacare. And the Democrats said, cool, okay, we'll put it in. It was a process that took about a year. There were not only public hearings here in Washington, D.C., and an amendment process and a markup process, both in committee and on the floor in both the House and the Senate. Not only all of that and all that transparency, but there were also meetings all over the country. Members of Congress went back to their districts. President Obama traveled around the country and had public meetings where people were asking questions. What is this going to mean for me? How does this work? You know, quack, quack, quack. It was a completely transparent process. That's a completely different thing from the Republicans locking themselves in a room in the Senate and in 5 days coming up with a bill that strips health care from 22 million people and hands a $600 billion tax cut to the 400 richest people in America and about 5,000 of their friends.
Okay. Well, that leads me to this last question. Me and my wife had insurance through her company, and we make about $60,000 a year combined, but we have to pay car payments, insurance,
sure.
not health insurance, but car insurance.
Yeah, so you're right in the middle of it.
All that. Yeah. So we had insurance, but then our insurance dropped us because they wanted too much money. So we went on the Obama exchange, and we're like, why not? You know, so we applied for insurance through the Obama exchanges. And the cheapest that we could get, which we couldn't afford, so we went a year. We just now got insurance again, but we went a year without insurance because they wanted us to pay $780 a month for insurance through the Obama exchanges.
Right.
So I hear people say how great Obamacare was, but what about the people that it wasn't so great for?
Well, you know, part of your problem is that you live in Florida, and Florida, much like Iowa, allows health insurance companies to sell non-standardized plans. And so mostly the people who are ending up on Obamacare are sicker, and that's driving up Obamacare costs, number one. Number two, Marco Rubio did away with the risk corridors 2 years ago, so the insurance companies are having to charge more. But I guarantee you, if you lived in other states, I mean, we're providing Obamacare policies to all of our employees, and it's what I have. Well, actually, I'm on Medicare. It's what my wife has right now. And it's costing us about $350 a month. So, you know, Obamacare is affordable in those places where it was implemented correctly. Florida did not expand Medicaid. And that drives up the cost of the individual policies. So, you know, your problem, David, is not Obamacare. It's Rick Scott. Thanks a lot for the call, David. Good to hear from you. Thanks for listening to us on SiriusXM. We will be back tomorrow. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy doesn't just happen. It requires you. It's not a spectator sport. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.